Mr. O'Sullivan, reel 21. So, we're talking off the tape, and you were saying that there was 20 of you in the hut at first, and then there was four new arrivals. Could you talk about that and how that?
Well, they just turned up at the landing with a sergeant major who was the overall sergeant major for the people who were out working in different parts of Germany from Stalag 4B. And there was one was a corporal Sampson, a Joe Price, and two more. I can't think who they were, I can't think of the names, I can't even visualise them.
But they're on the photograph that we have.
Yeah, they're on the photograph. And they joined us, when they joined us, they automatically was a brick breakers because they didn't, nobody else needed any. The staff didn't want any more, so they joined the brick. They went down to work at the brickworks. We had a bit of trouble with Sangster when he first came because he thought he should be senior and senior. He was a corporal. I think he was a sergeant, but he'd demoted himself so he could get out onto working parties.
So there was a rule that if you were a sergeant, you didn't have to work?
If you were a sergeant, you didn't go out to work. Sergeant or above. So he came in, he was a corporal. And he thought because he was a corporal and Dickie was only a lance corporal, that he should be main man. So we had a discussion about it and decided that Dickie Dunn would still be main man and he would just be one of the others, same as we were. I can't imagine, I can't visualise it. The other, Joe Price I got to know because we met him quite often. We get on with Joe Price. He come from Blackburn, I'm sure, yeah. I think he did that then. But I'll say one thing for Sangster. He had a pack of cards with him. And at night, they tried to teach us bridge. But once he got to know that he wasn't going to be in charge, he said, well, he accepted the fact that Dickie was still the main man. There wasn't a lot of. It didn't give Dickie any particular power, but he just negotiated between the German authorities and us. And Sangster tried to teach us bridge, and we had some quite good nights at playing cards. And we used to get some money, I'm sure we did. Because when he got this card, and of course bridge there's only four of us could play. So then we started having a card school. And all the money was kept in like a sandbag. All the money belonging to the lager. So we must have got something every day, every so often. I think we got a mark a day. But we couldn't buy it. Once they stopped buying the Polish cigarettes, there was nothing else much to spend money on. And it accumulated. So we used to play cards for money. And we'd empty the sandbag. All his paper money, pennies, and notes, and everybody, whoever was playing, maybe the most you can pay out is 6, 7 with the game of cards. We'd go to the card game and that sort of thing, and we'd gamble. But at night, when they were finished playing cards, all the money was put back into the sandbag. Nobody won the money, you know, to keep.
So it was like a game of Monopoly, that
kind of thing. Monopoly money. It was Monopoly money, what we had, really. Because it was no good to the German civilians, either. It wasn't proper marks.
Now, I think you told me off the tape a story about Sangster's escape attempt and so on. Can you just talk about the build-up to that? Because he was very, very keen on that. I think you could just explain how that...
He thought we should try to escape. And we all said, well, we're in the middle of bloody Germany, it's a waste of bloody time. So, this particular night, there was an air raid. Normally we used to hear the planes going over towards Berlin and Halle and Leipzig, and they never bothered us at all. We just carried on sleeping through it. But this particular night, there was an air raid much closer to us. And the sirens went. And Samson said, he'd already made these plans, him and whoever was going to get who went with him. He said, the first time there's an air raid, me and so-and-so's off. We'll be out undercover. And this air raid come on a Saturday night. We went to dig out or anything, but the postman come around, opened the gates and said, into the fields, there's some fields right side of us now. And so we're out, so there's no... And they dropped maybe one stick of bombs across the village. And it shattered nearly every window in the village. But also, there was a special stone factory in the centre of the village.
A special what factory?
Stone, brick. But they made special things. They made tiles. And one of the bombs must have just entered the top of the chimney and slid straight down, because it fetched the chimney down, but it didn't lay it down that way. It laid it down that way, flat, absolutely flat. So, thanks to Clay bullet off with his mate, and we went back into the post and never counted us back into the what he just had somewhere was all in. Locked the door, went. Next morning, the statman was called out, because the place was full of that paper, silver at one side and a black one. It interfered with the radar or something. The village was absolutely covered with it. Most of the windows were shattered. So the statman was going to work cleaning up. And the people didn't talk to us that day. They were very, very upset. And we thought, we got this paper. There was bags of it. It was all over the place, and when he told to clean up, we had to clean up most of the windows, the stat windows, what belonged to the if it was your house, you had to do your own cleaning up, but any part what belonged to the stat, we had to clean up outside and clean the windows inside. Anyway, during the morning, at midday, I left him to go to Mrs. Price to work. Johnny Eiley and Smithy had gone to work in the bathhouse, and all of a sudden the postman come down to fetch me back to the library, and as he was coming back we called and picked Smithy and Smithy and Eiley up. We went back to the library, and when we got to the library, the Sergeant Major's there, and he said to the postman, "How many have you got?" And he said, 24. He lined us all up, he said, count them. He went, 9, 12, 4, 5, 6, 7, 29, 20, 21, 22, two missing. His feet never touched. He arrested him that morning, and he already brought this new post, or was going to be our new post, with him. But I think he only got into trouble because he didn't know the gun. They'd been caught already. They was in the bloody wagon ready to come back into the lager when he didn't know the gun. So then we go on to the post.
We'll get on to the new guard. But Sangster and his friend came back. What was their story of what had happened to them?
Well, they got picked up really straight away. But they haven't got far as the forests. They haven't travelled above 4 miles before they'd been picked up with the German patrol.
Can you remember what their plan was before they left? Did they have a specific idea?
Well, yeah, they were going to look for the Black Forest area.
And then what were they going to do?
Well, then it was a matter of... They had no real plans. We'd supplied them with what food we could, but they had that with them when they come back anyway. They'd never even opened their haversacks to eat anything.
So who'd caught them?
Boys and
the Hitler Youth.
But you've got to remember, with the Hitler Youth, there was always some seniors, old soldiers. The Hitler Youth went all Hitler Youth. They were in charge of older soldiers. They had sergeant majors and sergeants the same as the army did.
And I mean, we'll talk about Sangster's abortive escape attempt. The rest of you, in the time that you'd been there from late 43, had you discussed the possibility of escape?
We got a map of the area, and was in the middle of Silesia, is it they call it? I think it's Silesia. Was it some? I don't know.
Was it be Saxony?
Saxony. Was in the middle of Saxony. There was no way we were going to make our way to a free country at that time, especially with the clothes we had was got big red patches on them. There was no way, and well, I don't think it was ever discussed.
What about Sangster?
When Sangster started talking about it, he said, "What was a bloody daft," you know. And I mean, he proved it. It was one really got far.
So when he was brought back this time, did he still have plans of escape?
No.
So that was it.
That was it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so your guard was replaced. Now, I think you told me off the tape a story about your first guard and his interest in music and so on. And maybe we could talk about that.
Oh, definitely. Well, it was even Tom Tunney and Smithy was interested in music. And once we got food parcels coming in, the atmosphere was more relaxed at night. We weren't talking about the Yorkshire puddings my mother used to make, and what we were talking. Tom Tunney and Smithy was talking about music, and they wanted to have a choir. You know, have a sing song. But it wasn't going to be any old sing song; it had to be done properly. And they got talking to the postman about it, and he brought them some sheet music of Lily Marlene, of the and. We used to do a bit of a practice singing at night, but it never went well because we couldn't sing well enough to suit your father. We could not, and me, he told me I couldn't really hold a note. Or I didn't know really know what I was singing. I didn't even know what I was singing. Anyway, we used to have some fun, but Tom was a bit. He thought people should be as interested in what he was doing as he was, and the music should be proper, right. That's what it had to be with Tom. It had to be right, but we had some fun.
What songs did you sing? You sang Louis Marlene.
We used to sing Louis Marlene, and we used to, what did I used to sing? I forget what I used to sing. Tom used to say, "Listen to your bloody self." What the hell was it? I can't think what it was, but I know what I'm thinking about. About a bird singing, and there's no in the. What the hell did they call that song? Anyway, I know I didn't do it right for Tom. You say, "Listen to your bloody self. You don't even make sense." The song, the way I sang it, I was getting the words wrong as well. And I'll tell you what that bloody song was one of those. Let's think about it.
Now, you mentioned Ray Smith, and I think off the tip you said he was kind of a bit posher than everybody else, you thought.
Well, he talked better than anybody else. And he'd had a better education than most of us. And he was a musician as well. I would say him and your dad had experience in music far beyond any of us others. Because I think Ray was a musician. Ray could certainly play the piano. Because he tried it once, and Mrs. Price had a piano. I know what he was playing that.
Now, the Red Cross provided parcels, but apparently they also provided other materials to the various camps. What did you get anything else from them?
What did you play an accordion? You got an accordion. Ray Smith could play it. That's why he could play the piano, wouldn't it? Because he could play a piano accordion.
And did you get anything else? You got an accordion, what else? Any books or?
Yeah, we got some books. I can't remember what they were though, because I wasn't interested in reading at that time. But and we got some more playing cards. They provided us with Smithy got another music book. One like you by the seaside, you know, where they had a single on the prom, all like that.
So it was like a song book?
A song sheet, yeah, a song sheet. So, we enjoyed it, we had a good time in that respect. The following Christmas, we had a bit of a Christmas concert.
We'll get to that one when we get to the Christmas. So we're still kind of in early 44. I think off the tip, you mentioned a story about Mrs. Price and Mrs. Price's husband. Could you talk about that?
Well, Mrs. Price's husband was a soldier. He was in the German clerking corps, and he was a corporal. They did call him corporal, but he was lower down than a sergeant. And he came on leave, embarkation leave, or whatever they like to call it. He knew he was going to Russia. So he came on, he was home for about 7 days. And he was an abrupt sort of a man, very bossy with the women. His two daughters were terrified of him, but they were very much aware of him, especially the older one, you know. Christina wasn't his daughter. Mrs. Price was Emma's daughter before she got married. Then to another one. So Emma was a little bit frightened of her father. Anyway, Mrs. Price decided that when he was going back, he'd been home about 6 or 7 days, and the night he was going back, she had a party for him. We had snaps, we had quite cake. She'd been in on some of the stuff out of the cellar, and she prepared a really good meal. And there was, must have been 7 men, one of them was me. And that was amazing was that it was a party for the father, but the two girls didn't sit down at the table with us. There was Mrs. Price and Mr. Price, me, and some of their friends at Milford. Who weren't in the army, by the way. One was a shopkeeper, who was there at haberdashery. So there was Mrs. Price's father. Because he was an old man, he must have been 60, 70. And he taught me to tell time.
What was that? Tell time in German?
Yeah. There was about 7 of us all together, etc. And it really did surprise me that the girls weren't invited to sit at the same. It surprised me that I sat at the table and they didn't.
And what did Mr. Price think about you being there?
Well, as soldiers, we got on all right.
And what did he think? What did
but he thought there was losing, they were losing the war.
And he said that?
Yeah. He said that he told his wife he didn't expect her to see her again. Because the Russian front was, I mean, a lot of the German soldiers who was old and kicking about, in like the one who wrote that Boston, same as ours, he was frightened that after he'd done his term in Klagenfurt, he was sent to the Russian front. They were terrified of the Russian front, and Mr. Price didn't expect to come back.
And what was his attitude towards you? As the two countries were at war.
We were looking. How lucky we were. He said, you'll see the end of the war. You know, I mean, even if Germany had won the war, we should have seen the end of it, shouldn't we? But he said that whether he was or not, he was very doubtful. And he knew there was. Well, that's all we knew. He wasn't surprised that the war was going against him.
And had he been involved in earlier campaigns?
Yeah, he'd been in Africa at one time, early on. But he was in the Curtain Corps, and he said, obviously, we didn't see the front line. As you said, going to Russia, it's the front lines nowhere. That was the feeling of Russia, that there's, even though it was in the catering corps, that they'd be overrun or they'd be isolated by the weather or the forces.
But he wasn't, he didn't have any objections to you?
Oh, no.
What did you feel, you know, you were a British soldier, you were in Germany, and you become friends with Mrs. Price and certainly be workmate as well. What did you feel about that, these two countries at war, and yet you were...
Well, I thought we were very similar in attitudes to one another. We were very... The German men, as I say, were a bit ignorant, arrogant, not ignorant, arrogant, towards the women. And that's what struck me, because we weren't, and the Americans weren't. And it always struck me as wrong that the women were second class citizens. Another little point about me, there was no dogs in Germany. They'd been killed. There were no dogs at all in the village. No cats either.
What, they'd been killed and eaten?
Well, whether it was eaten or not, I don't know, but they'd certainly been killed. Because nearly everybody had dog carts. You know, in the house, it was a cart which had sort of a handle on it for a dog, what you could harness to a dog. But there was no dogs. I don't think they ever saw a dog.
Now, over this period, were you aware that there was the air raids were?
Well, the air raids were getting worse.
Were there any other memorable events on that score, just in this early period, the pre-D-Day period?
Yeah, every day, and we could see flying fortresses going over. Not just one or two, but hundreds of them. And they were really pounding Berlin, Halle, Leipzig. And there didn't seem to be any German activity, you know, try and beat them. But what I did notice in Germany, this new postman we got, he was much more hands-on sort of business. After work, particularly on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday, he would take us out to play football to a field. And this Sunday morning, he was going for a game of football on the field. Oh no, it was Sunday afternoon because I was going in, I worked somewhere. So it was Sunday afternoon, we were going for a game of football, which he played with us, and he was the fittest lad on the field. This Sunday afternoon, he was walking down the track. Well, we didn't walk, we marched, they always marched us wherever we went. So Ben now in front, and all of us. And a jet aeroplane flew over. And we all dived at the side of, into the bed because it sounded just like a shell. And that was the first jet engine we had. And it was being flown from Pritch on the River Elbe. It was an airplane. And that was the first jet engine I ever heard.
So you heard this thing. What was your reaction when you?
Oh, the speed of it was, you know, in comparison to all the planes, it was terrific.
So what did you think about that when you saw the thing?
Well, what is it? We've got a better plane than us. Because we'd never heard we knew the buzz bombs was going to get out of England and that sort of thing, but this was an aeroplane lot.
Did that make... Did you lose a bit of morale over that?
No, I don't think so. We talked about it.
Did the guard jump as well, or was he used to it?
Oh, he jumped as well. We all went. We all reacted like bloody soldiers on the route march. We just dived into the edge bottom.
Because it was something you'd never heard before except as the sound of it.
It's just like a shell, whistling over. Jesus, what's that?
Now, on that subject of the new guard, you said he was fit, but I think you mentioned off the tape he was...
He'd been injured.
In what way?
One of his arms was he hadn't lost his arm, but he'd lost the use of it. But he once came into the, when he first joined us, when he first came to us, he brought his rifle into the back when we were there, to show us his arms drawn. and he could, well, he was very, very smart with his arms. He could slow arms and port arms and as good as any British soldier ever was seen. And he was, in his dress, he was immaculate. He was really a different guy to what we had. And we thought, oh, really, what have we got here? But actually, it turned out, because he was a frontline soldier, he treated us like frontline soldiers. I mean, we'd take a, when we went to play football, there's 24 of us. Well, Jim Britton couldn't play. Davis couldn't play. Because he had a bad leg. Jim Britton was nearly always bad leg.
They were both war wounded from earlier campaigns.
Mm. So, pick a team, and they'd say, well, you've got 10 men and they've got 11, I'll play with you. He was bloody good. He was, he really was. But he was good in a way that he knew he was better than us, he was fitter than us, because he obviously just come out of the army, he'd come less somewhere. But he never rubbed it in, but he liked to show us that he was
good. And what kind of, how old was he? What kind of?
Round about 26, 27, I would say.
And did he ever talk about his experiences?
No. He never spent more time with it, apart from football, football or whatever he wanted to do when he took us out into this field. If he didn't want to play football, he could run. Or, but he never spent a lot of time with us otherwise. And that's just every stab come up to visit him.
And where was this dad from?
I don't know where he came from. I don't know where he came from.
And his dad came up and what happened?
His dad used to come up. And I think his dad must have been another soldier. But he was too old to be a soldier. And he used to come up and come for 2 or 3 days and stop him. He'd sleep in his billet.
Which was next to yours?
Well, our billet was in the back of the house. His billet was on sort of on the front street. And he had his own entrance, his sister's entrance. And the farmer, or the coalman, he was a bit of both, I think, lived behind us. And his house was joined on our house. And we had the downstairs and he was upstairs.
How did you get on with the farmer?
Well, I didn't come in contact with him a lot. The only time we came in contact with him was if we had to borrow his horse and cart, and he was driving.
And I think you said off the tip, he was also the local coal merchant.
He was a coal merchant, a farmer. In general, his horse and cart was used for a lot of different jobs. The stat often borrowed it. You know, if he was going out to cut wood, he'd take his horse and cart. If we went to refill our palliasses, he'd go on his horse and cart.
Now,
everybody used him.
And so there weren't many horse and carts in the village then?
There was only that one, I don't know.
Now, when did you start to notice the German morale starting to crumble in terms of their, because they were very optimistic, you were saying, about the war when you first got to Germany. When did it start to change?
Middle of 1944. And that's when. That was after Mr. Price had gone back to Russia, where he'd gone, and she was in her own with the 2 girls. And I spent more and more time with her. Sometimes we used to go back to the line 10 o'clock at night.
And had you got to the stage where you could walk around on your own at this time?
I could, yeah.
And what did the guard know about this?
Yeah.
And he just tolerated it as well?
Yeah.
What do you think his attitude to the war was, the guard?
He was an intelligent man. The German news. It was silly for him to say that the invasion had been. When the invasion first started, we'd been pushed back into the sea, according to the German news. And they'd been destroyed, you know, they held us off Normandy and they'd done this and done that and the other, and there was all in this one. But a week later, it was no use telling them that they were still going back in the sea, because There are some journals that have already been overrun, haven't they?